I am your host, Mark McBride-Wright, founder and managing director of Equal Engineers, and I believe that every engineer has a story to tell. The Equal Engineers podcast uncovers the diversity story behind leading engineers and those working with the profession championing change. Hear from leaders, academics, entrepreneurs, and agents of change, truly transforming the understanding of who engineers are and what engineers do. Hi everyone, I am Mark McBride-Wright, founder and managing director of Equal Engineers, and I'm delighted to welcome you to today's podcast, where we have Craig Orrick, who is treasurer of the UK Students for the Exploration and Development of Space, a third year mechanical engineering student at Heriot Watt University in Scotland, and also winner of Engineering Student of the Year at the Engineering Talent Awards 2021, and also the Overall Excellence in Engineering Award as well. Craig, how are you?
Yeah, I'm doing great. It's fantastic to be here and to be able to talk about my experiences.
Fantastic. It's really, really, really great to have you on. So in terms of like the structure of what we go through, we like to look a little bit in the past about your past history, bit about who you are, find out about your diversity story. And then we spend a bit of time looking forward to the future, looking at the present and looking forward to the future to get your take on, how things might change going forwards and what you hope to do. So if we can just start at the beginning, and I'm conscious that you're also a student. So in terms of lived experience in industry, and we're actually to start my usual question as where did you grow up and what was the young Craig like? You're still very young. So with that in mind.
Yeah. So going way back to the beginning. So I grew up in rural Scotland in a part of the country called Perthshire. It's really far away from big cities, in very, very small town. And in terms of young Craig, I think it was one of those very stereotypical thing of engineers where, I always had an interest in science and maths, which most engineers find themselves doing so. But I think, my experience being able to grow up in such a rural part of the country meant, I was able to go out on adventures, I was able to look around. Mm. I think it was very different to someone growing up in a city. Mm. And because I grew up in such a rural area, I found that, I just really preferred it. I just really enjoyed it. Because now I live in a bigger city, I just feel like it's just not quite the same.
Okay. So that sort of curiosity, that ability to just get out into the natural world and explore around you. I mean, so I grew up in Edinburgh, outside of Edinburgh, and even the difference between Edinburgh and Midlothian, the skies were darker. You could see the stars. So in Perthshire, I can imagine you've got that luxury of having even less light pollution compared to the central belt in Scotland. Did looking up into the sky, what made you get into your interest in space?
Yeah, I think it was being able, like you say, there's just such little light pollution. The night sky, it was really just there for you to sort of take it in and its entire scope of it and just be able to really appreciate it. And I think that coupled with growing up watching old Star Trek episodes really sort of, pushed for the interest in space.
Amazing. So they were one of your sources of inspiration, the old Star Trek episode.
I mean, who wouldn't want to be Captain Kirk?
Yes, absolutely. So how would you describe your school days and your journey towards deciding to study mechanical engineering?
Yeah, so moving to high school, I think it was always the sort of, I knew I kind of liked science and I kind of liked maths and I liked space, but I didn't really have a sort of clear plan of, this is what I'm going to do. But, I realized I started getting more interested into rockets. I started watching, It's all your brand new rocket engine launching, brand new rockets, brand new companies designing rocket engines. And then that sort of propelled my interest. And then from there to sort of, okay, I like rocket engine. What do I need to do to get there? And then I think that's when I found mechanical engineering to be a very good match. I find, you know, mechanical engineering allowing me to get into, really stuck into rocket engines. Just because, you know, I wanted to build a spaceship. Again, you know, Star Trek. I wanted to build the rocket engine, and that's kind of what influenced me into picking mechanical engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, hopefully when I graduate, I want to get into propulsion engineering.
Amazing.
It's very much a case of, I like this, how do I do it? As opposed to anything else.
So is that, I mean, what pastimes do you enjoy? Is that one of your, something that you extend into your spare time as well?
Yeah, I mean, well, it's like that old saying, if you like your work, you'll never work a day in your life.
I like that.
And I absolutely love rocket engine. I'm actually working on my own personal engine at the moment. You know,
wow.
It's only very, very small. It's only 10 newtons. But, you know, that is just how much I like rocket engines. You know, I work on it at home. I work on it at uni. I work on them in my extracurriculars. I just can't get enough of them.
So I mean, I studied physics and I do know a bit of propulsion, and I'm aware of what a force of 10 newtons can do, but applying that to rocket physics, and some of our listeners might not even know what that means. It's only 10 newtons. Give us some context. Give us some scale.
So 10 newtons, or if you prefer to rephrase it, that's about 1 kilogram of thrust, or about 2 pounds of thrust, as in this is how much force. If you were to hold the rocket engine in your hand while it's firing, that's how much I would feel like it weighed.
Right.
If you like, if that sort of thrust. 1 kilogram of thrust, that's absolutely nothing compared to the, you know, the rockets where it launched people to the moon, where like in the thousands, if not million of kilograms of mm-hmm. thrust. But, you know, it's a very small rocket engine.
So if you were to put that in your, I'm imagining here a Coke bottle, some sort of fizzy drink bottle in your garden, with some mechanism at the base of it that's going to give some thrust, will that shoot up high into the sky, or will it just lift off the ground? Like what?
Yeah, not quite. Basically, what it is something that you call a spark igniter, which basically means because in big rocket engine, because they're using like liquid oxygen and liquid methane, very, very cold. So what this spark igniter does is basically it's a miniature rocket engine. And this miniature rocket engine, you'd actually use the exhaust from this miniature rocket engine to start the big rocket engine.
Right.
So basically, I'm just working on the igniter part of it, if you like,
a big rocket. I see.
So it's basically having two rocket engines in one. We use a small one to ignite the big one.
Right.
And it's much easier to ignite the small one, like maybe a spark plug.
Yeah. I guess it's not really the sort of thing you can just go out and do in a field in public. People might be wondering, where's that boundary between personal pursuit and is this person a national security threat?
Yeah, I mean, you know, surprisingly, people are a bit wary when you ask them, can I buy a rocket engine in your field or garden? but fortunately, I've got some contact, and they're able to find just a great big open empty bit of land. Nice and safe, nice and far away from everyone else.
Yeah.
So, you know, I will just be in a field somewhere.
Yeah.
But yeah, nice and safe. You know, safety is always paramount to these sort of things.
Yes.
Because rocketry is just so dangerous. You know, we all want to make sure, you know, can everything that you could do by hand, you could do remotely, like 500 meters away as well.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, no, of course. You're reminding me of in my days of safety engineering, when I was a technical safety engineer, and I never got to do it. Always wanted to go and visit. It was a company called DNVGL, and they run a facility in Spade Adam in the north of England, and it's the test facility of where they mimic incidents, and they look at, you know, plume clouds or radiation or thermal radiation to try and mimic major accident hazard scenarios that come out of big events happening, so that our technical safety engineering models have more, they're less theoretical and more mimicking what actually happens. And so, yeah, I think there's videos you can watch on YouTube, actually, of tests that they've done. So I guess it wasn't quite rocket propulsion, but that was the equivalent of the big explosions in my field of engineering. that I never got to visit. But absolutely, safety is always paramount, and it's you have to risk assess it and mitigate and reduce, swap out things if you can, swap them out for safer alternatives. So safety must play a big part in your risk assessment that you have to do.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you should see my checklist. It's about an inch thick, just because I want to record every single possible risk and every single possible thing that could possibly go wrong, no matter how small. It's very, very integral to Focket propulsion engineering.
Yeah, I see.
I mean, even in my extracurricular, for example, where we're building a slightly bigger engine with Endeavour, which is University of Edinburgh Rocket Society, then we're still doing everything as safe as possible. We cannot afford to have any accidents. It's just not worth the risk.
Absolutely. So what have been some of the key experiences that have shaped who you are?
Yeah, so in terms of who I am, I think, like I said, in old Star Trek episodes, I always used to just love watching them and just being able to see, see the curiosity, see how just motivated and ready they were to just sort of get out there, explore, and just find new things. I think that kind of ended up influencing my personality a little bit. I end up being a little bit like that, where, I really just find really exciting and engaging to get into things, and I just wanted to find out more about everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I found in high school I had a few teachers who were very encouraging of this, and a few teachers who really sort of allowed me the opportunity to get stuck in and find out more about stuff. Mm. I think that sort of really influenced and put me on the path of wanting to become an engineer.
Amazing.
And being able to just sort of do the same sort of being curious and finding out things, but getting paid for it.
Yeah. Something applied. So you've spoken openly about being deaf, hard of hearing. Can you tell us a bit about your experiences being an engineer, how you've managed your studies? Because there'll be people out there listening to this that haven't walked in those shoes, that have no experience of working with someone who's hard of hearing. So this would be a great opportunity to just hear from someone with that lived experience what it's like and how best people can support.
Yeah, so a very brief background. I was born deaf. I've been deaf all my life. I have these medical implants called cochlear implants, and they actually allow me to hear. People think, they must give you perfect hearing. They really don't. They give you a sort of very limited form of hearing.
Okay.
They can kind of get away with, but just not anything near as good as normal hearing, or ordinary hearing, if you like. So I think something to be very wary of, and just remember, the person that you're talking to is still deaf.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for instance, you can hear me, I'm talking. I think sometimes I talk better than I can hear.
Okay.
Like, because my deaf accent may be relatively mild or maybe not so obvious, but I am still deaf. I think it's mostly just common sense stuff, and trying to accommodate someone who is deaf or hard of hearing is just, make sure you're in a quiet environment, make mm-hmm. sure captions are available everywhere you can,
mm-hmm.
make sure you're talking clearly at a reasonable pace, just make sure, I think it's just mostly common sense stuff.
Yeah.
But, I think it's very easy to just accidentally forget it. Or just not think of it.
And how was it through your school career, through education, did you get the right support that you needed? I mean, clearly for you to go on and secure a place at Heriot Watt University, how did you find being in education before university?
Yeah, I mean, I was very fortunate. When I was at high school, I was very fortunate that I had a very good access to disability equipment. So,
okay.
For instance, I had a very small microphone device that I can give to teachers, could wear, which really helped me significantly. And I know there's a lot of other people who were in my shoes but didn't quite get the support they needed.
Okay.
That's a very, very big problem. I was very fortunate. I had access to all the technology, I had access to this help and equipment, which allowed me to, go on to further study.
Okay. And is there are there any places that we can signpost people to learn a bit more about how to support So, for example, that example that you just gave about microphones being worn by a teacher, that did they tune in directly to your implants? And so how did they work?
Yeah, so my implant, they have like a little receiver you can put in, a small receiver, and what it does is basically if someone's being given a microphone, but it goes straight to your ear implant.
Right.
So I could sit anywhere in the room, a classroom, a lecture theatre if you like, and it'll sound like they're just standing beside me.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people don't realise, and obviously your ear basically acts as like a gigantic antenna.
Yeah.
So you can pick up sound waves, but my implant don't offer that. I've got a very, very small limited microphone, which has an extremely limited range.
Right.
So this microphone just helps to sort of augment that, if you like.
Got you.
And yeah, in terms of, you know, finding out more about deaf stuff, I would recommend Deaf Action. Deaf Action, it's a charity run and led by deaf people. And they've got, you know, resources on sign language. They've got resources on helping deaf people. They do a lot of really good stuff.
Okay.
I would highly recommend it.
Okay. Absolutely. We'll put a link to that in the transcription of this podcast when we have it produced. So coming to the present then, as I mentioned in the intro, in 2021, you won the Engineering Student of the Year category at the Engineering Talent Awards. And then you also went on to win the Winner of Winners, the Overall Excellence in Engineering Award. What did this mean for you? What do you hope to do with this platform in the future?
I mean, getting the email and finding out I was a finalist was already quite a big shock. And then I turn up to the award ceremony and I find out I'm Engineering Student of the Year, an even bigger shock. And then all of a sudden, here we go, here's this big, gigantic award, and I've won that one as well. So that was just a massive shock. But it's very much appreciated. And, you know, it's a really good platform now. I'm able to talk to employers. I'm able to find myself, you know, with a much bigger audience than I would normally have had. And, you know, it means I can use the platform to maybe continue to advocate for deaf people, continue to provide a voice for people who maybe aren't able to advocate for themselves, and just try to really encourage everyone to just take into consideration, you know, deaf people, hard of hearing people, and what can you do to make their life just that little bit easier.
I love it. And I'm really pleased that it's been able to allow you to do that. And hopefully, you know, when you come for applying for job roles, to become that propulsion engineering specialist, a propulsion engineer, rocket engineer, you'll go on to achieve great things with this as well. Which brings back my next question. In the last few years alongside your degree, you've worked for the UK Students for the Exploration and Development of Space, UK SEDS organisation. That is a bit of a mouthful. It would be nice if they could condense the acronym a little bit. I always have to remind myself what it stands for. Can you tell us a bit more about the work of the organisation?
Yeah, so to give us sort of a very brief description of UK SEDS, SEDS itself is like an international movement to try and encourage students to join the space sector, Student for the Exploration and Development of Space. UK SEDS is the UK chapter of it.
Okay.
It's like SEDS USA, we've got SEDS India, you know, we've got lots of different countries around the world starting their own SEDS branches, but UK SEDS is obviously the one for the UK. So I'm part of the executive committee, which means I oversee and I'm able to help sort of steer the direction of UK SEDS.
Okay.
And in terms of work I do with them, you know, I really appreciate the opportunity they've given me, because I've been able to, you know, attend events, I've been able to attend conferences, and just sort of continue to advocate for students and trying to encourage students to join the space sector, and just trying to show them, you know, because a lot of people may think, you know, oh, well, if I want to do space stuff, I've got to be a scientist or I've got to be an engineer, but you really don't necessarily have to be. You know, there are plenty of different opportunities out there for you to join the space sector. I mean, even right now, for example, we're planning a big conference of the year, a National Student Space Conference. And, you know, from there, we're able to give students the opportunity to speak to all these, like, really big employers and really big companies recruiting people to join the space sector. So that's the sort of stuff we do.
And how can people, when is that due to take place, and how can people find out more information about it?
Yeah, so that... The 2022 one will be held on the 5th to 6th of March, and our host university, our partner university for that year, is King College London.
Okay.
If you want to find out more about NSSC, you can go to uksouth.org/NSSC. You can find out more information about it. You can find out the companies that are going to be attending, and you'll also be able to secure a ticket there as well.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So can you give us an idea of the UK space sector? What size is it? How many organizations are in it? What's it worth? How many employees? Any statistics that you've got? Because it's some, I think NASA in the US is just still such a dominant brand when you think about space, that people might not necessarily realize that we've got stuff happening on British soil.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, like you say, it's a bit of a cultural phenomenon where, you know, it's a very sort of, you see all the American movies and American cultural product where they push NASA, and you really don't realize we've got a very good homegrown, if you like, space sector right here in the UK.
Okay.
We're talking, you know, tens of thousands of people working in the UK space sector.
Wow.
You know, turn over £1 billion, which is, and the UK government has set a target of aiming to capture 10% of the global space sector market by 2030.
Wow.
So, you know, we're really pushing for the space sector to go. I mean, for example, Glasgow is actually the number one place in the whole of Europe for small satellites.
Wow.
Because there's this thing called CubeSat, for example, which is only a 10 centimeter by 10 centimeter satellite in the shape of a cube. And you know, very sort of cheap, low cost satellites, which allow universities and students the opportunity to develop satellite hardware at an affordable cost. And Glasgow is basically pioneering the effort behind that.
Wow. So it makes it more accessible for people to
absolutely
launch because, you know, satellites.
Because, you know, when you think of a satellite, you think this great big gigantic thing takes up an entire room, but it doesn't need to be. It can be very, very small, very cheap, very accessible.
Okay.
And in terms of getting these satellites to space, people don't realize that, but in the UK, we actually got, I believe, about seven spaceports in either getting built or under construction or getting planned in some way or form.
Wow.
So, you know, we've got seven different places to launch stuff to space.
Amazing.
In the UK alone.
Amazing. You mentioned in your Engineer Talent Award nomination about a vision to embed accessibility into the very inception of event planning and event delivery. So that's always a consideration and not an add-on activity. What advice do you have for event planners out there to help with this?
I think see, the problem is when people are doing the event and they're so busy thinking about events and how to do that, it's very easy to sort of forget or marginalize, well, how would a deaf person experience this event? How would a visually impaired person experience this event? What is it like to be in their shoes and trying to access this? So I think the most fundamental thing would be, you know, just talk to people who are having to live these experiences. Just talk to them, ask them, what can I do to make the event accessible for you? And just sort of really consider, well, imagine that I have no access to sound at all. How will this event look like to me?
Yeah.
Or imagine if I have no ability to be able to see, for example, well, how will this event look to me? Just sort of trying to think and understand and put yourself in their shoes.
Yeah. And then actually budget for it from the very beginning.
Yeah, it's far too often, and very unfortunate, a lot of people just see that as something to do towards the very end, just a very little add-on. Okay, what's the minimum I can do to help them? But really, it should be incorporated into your planning from day one, if you can. It should be a key part of all your planning decisions.
Yeah, because actually, if you invest in that transcription service, you then have a written transcript of everything that was said, which is great for post-event documentation.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, all these things aren't necessarily limited just to helping disabled or helping people access the event. You know, there's plenty of benefits for fully able people to be able to use these same services to be able to access the event as well.
That's something that I try and live and breathe. And even with the best intentions, there's still moments of learning to happen as you come through. So it's, you know, Eco Engineers is by no means perfect for what we've done to date, but we're always trying to learn and practice best practice and embedding from the very beginning of inception of any new ideas, what we do. Actually, I can share with you, when I launched Equal Engineers in 2017, our first ever careers fair, we had, it was all singing, all dancing. We had 35 exhibitors. I had 500 students. We had parallel panel discussions happening, and we did one on each diversity strand. And then on the one on disability, we only had one person put their name forward to be on the panel. And it was a deaf engineer from a construction employer. And I hadn't budgeted for filming. I was making them podcasts. And I thought, how ironic to make a podcast, but then, you know, would Simon be able to consume the content afterwards? You know, this is my lack of knowledge of the varying different, the spectrum of, you know, the deaf community, and the various levels. And I thought, how it sounds simple, but I thought, how do you create an inclusive podcast? And so that's why, after a Google search, and the obvious thing that comes up is that you provide a transcript, I always budget for it. Every time I'm planning a podcast now, I just be like, right, I've got my platform that I use that provides a quick transcription service. You know, I've used some of the AI stuff, and you end up having to do all the edits anyway to correct it. So now I've got a service that I use. But in those early days, actually transcribed it ourselves, word for word. And that was so time consuming that, I think what people need to realize out there is that there are very, very affordable tools out there that allow you to embed practicing this from the get-go, so that it isn't onerous and it doesn't feel feel difficult to do. It has to be easy to do. Tech is there to make things easy for us to do. We just need to build it into our workflow. And then, as you say, there are so many benefits that then stem from that, having that written record, in particular when it comes to the podcast transcription piece. So that was a learning moment for me when setting up Equal Engineers. You know, I was stepping into running an organization that was to represent other strands that I don't identify with or that I'm not. And I was stepping into that fear that leaders have, that walking on eggshells feeling that am I going to offend? Am I going to say the wrong thing? You know, I want to show my positive intent to be continuously learning. And then the next time I arrived at that that journey so intimately, I guess, was when running the Engineering Talent Awards. And then, you know, knowing that you were being shortlisted, and I hadn't put that in from the beginning, you know, in my event planning, running a live event. Obviously, going forwards, that is now going to be baked into the event plan. So it just, even those of us that are the most enlightened or have the best will in the world, you know, we can always all do better and all learn. That's why it's so important to have people like yourself share your story, like make people walk in your shoes if they're not actively doing it, so that we continue to, you know, push ahead with better inclusion for all.
Yeah, I mean, exactly like you're saying, you know, accessibility doesn't have to be expensive. There's plenty of very affordable options out there. I mean, you know, for example, for a deaf person, you know, it's including transcripts, including captioning all your videos, recorded videos after the fact, and providing live transcripts. There's plenty of services out there. And then, you know, for example, say if someone's got a mobility issue, or simply just make sure, you know, whatever venue you're in, you've got access to, you know, elevators, you've got access, all the walkways are nice and clear of any obstructions. You know, it's very sort of relatively simple thing that you might not otherwise think of until you've been able to speak to someone who's lived those experiences. And yeah, it doesn't need to break the bank or anything. It's very, very affordable, very easy to do so. It's just, a lot of the time, it's just not a core part of the event planning process when it really needs to be.
And you almost need to have an accessibility checklist. There are some available online. One of the things that I've started doing each time I hire a new venue is firstly doing a site tour to make sure that, you know, it's accessible. I once hired a venue where there was no elevator. No, sorry, there was an elevator, but it was the goods lift. So it was the lift at the back that the catering company and all that had to use, rather than there weren't any fancy lifts at the front of the building for the public. It was via an escalator. And I mean, yeah, I was just, it was a massive oversight on my part, but you learn, you know. So now it's always something I look out for. And I've actually started asking venues ahead of them getting our services, can you send me a copy of your accessibility guide? Because some organizations have building accessibility statements. And if they don't have one, I'll then share one with them, which in my view represents a good overview of what you're covering. So it's then sort of getting them to think ahead around what improvements could we make, where we are restricted with like a grade one, grade two listed building that was built, you know, over 100 years ago, where this wasn't a design consideration. How can we adjust the facility, or at least flag up to people that there is going to be a limitation here? And then it's up to the event organizer to make that decision as to whether or not to work with that venue. But I do think that it's right now, it's just too, as you say, on the side, peripheral. It's an afterthought.
I mean, it's when you're planning the event, if you're thinking about accessibility from the very beginning, it's very easy and relatively straightforward to implement all these things. It's when you're on the other side of this event planning and then maybe a week out from the venue, that's where it starts to be really difficult and get really expensive to include accessibility. So, mm-hmm. you know, the earlier you plan for it, the much better the experience overall will be for people.
And that actually applies to engineering design. Like the the earlier in your design process that you accommodate for X, Y, and Z, the less expensive it will be further down the line, where you have to have add-on layers. I always think of design like how we used to do safety. So I used to work in the concept design phase, like three stages of design: concept design, front-end engineering design, and then engineering construction operations. And in the concept design phase, you had a lot more degrees of freedom. You could blue sky thinking, you had more controls over what you could do. And it, from a safety perspective, we always used to put everything through something called an inherent safety design workshop, where we would look at all our design options and we would think, right, are there things that we could do better here across the platforms? Or it was oil and gas platforms used to work on. So could we create some separation? Could we add in some blast walls? Could we replace one of the hydrocarbons for something that's less flammable, less explosive? You know, are there alternative chemistry processes that could be used to produce this product? And when I started working on some construction projects and infrastructure projects, so moving away from offshore to onshore, it really made me think about how much more we could be doing in engineering design about looking at accessibility as a lens through the design chain, not just thinking about accessibility of the end user, of the member of the public or the member of staff who's going to be working on this facility or consuming this product or service, the beneficiary, but actually through the design process, thinking about inclusive engineering design. That's where the having diverse teams then comes into it. You know, if you've got a diversity of perspectives within the engineering design team, you're more likely to be covering all grounds. And so it means cost savings that you might incur further, the costs that you might incur further down the line can be avoided if you start thinking about accessibility from the beginning. So I'm curious to hear from you as a future engineer, as a future leader in the sector, what are you doing? Are university students now considering accessibility through your engineering studies?
See, I think the problem is that I think it's one of the cultural things where it's very fundamental where you're trying to still encourage people to consider accessibility from the very beginning. And like you say, you know, you're trying to view things through an accessible lens, if you like. But I just think students aren't being provided enough resources or even just being given the awareness of thinking, well, okay, but not everyone is going to be fully able. Not everyone is going to fit into your perfect little box, or not everyone's going to fit into the box of your ideal customer or ideal consumer. You know, there's a wide range of, you know, people, abilities, different backgrounds. And because, you know, I feel like because a lot of the time you all see a lot of products and services being designed for someone who is fully abled, when in reality, that is just not the case.
Yeah.
So I think there still needs to be some significant work done to try and sort of, you know, get people to think about it all the way back in their studies, university studies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe that'll be able to then be carried within them towards their career.
Okay.
And sort of not looking forward.
So there's work to do there then. Work to do, absolutely. On bringing that forward.
But, okay. You know, I mean, being able to be given the platform, hopefully I can then, you know, be able to use that as a force of good and trying to sort of encourage that sort of process.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. We are working on that right now as Equal Engineers, because we have we've got a wide network that comprise universities, engineering employers, engineering institutions, and just trying to triangulate all of that represents a huge opportunity for Equal Engineers going forward. And so we are working behind the scenes on some projects, some activities. It all comes down to funding. So we're just working out mechanisms that can help then make some of these ideas come to fruition. My vision is that every single engineering student in the United Kingdom should be going through the training that we do with engineering industry, our creating inclusive cultures training, our inclusive design training. So the modules that we work on with engineers that make engineers go, oh, I hadn't thought of it that way before, bringing that forward and then doing it within the engineering curriculum, that means that we're then firstly training the leaders of the future in these principles. And then secondly, we're raising the bar of what you're asking when you go to an interview with your engineering employer. You have the engineering capital to ask these questions around how they're living these values and practicing these values professionally in their organization. So we start creating this big feed forward loop of learning that then catalyzes sort of diversity and inclusion not being peripheral and on the side and add on, but starts to become just part of the fabric of how we do our engineering.
Yeah, I mean, for an example, if you're thinking of, you know, you're trying to encourage maybe people that are already in the workplace, people that have been in the workplace for maybe 20 or 30 years by this point, you know, it's good to try and encourage them to think of it. But the earlier you can do it, the better. Because like you said, it's very much a feedback loop. If you're teaching students at the beginning of their careers, well, here's how to be more inclusive, they can then take that knowledge with them.
Yes.
And take it to their own companies, take it to their own careers, and they can sort of share that knowledge themselves.
Yeah.
No, as opposed to having to try and, you know, tell people who are already very established in the workplace and try and change their very long-term habits and mm-hmm. trying to encourage them. It's much better to be able to try and have that organic growth where students are just sort of slowly transforming the workplace themselves as they find employment.
Absolutely. No, watch this space then. We'll work on things together. So what would you say to anyone out there who's questioning whether or not to study engineering?
Yeah, so the degree or college course that you decide to study, you know, it's a very, very big and pivotal decision in your life. And if you're considering engineering, I would say it's absolutely worth it. Because with engineering, obviously, when people think about engineering, you think of, well, okay, you're going to make things, but you don't necessarily have to be limited in that way. Because when you graduate an engineering degree, what you're saying to employers is, I have studied engineering, I have the ability to think critically, I have the ability to think about how to solve problems, I can think about how to communicate to people. It's a lot of these various sort of soft skills that you get in engineering that you may not find with other courses or other subject areas. And you're not limited to just, when people think of engineering, they think, you know, well, I'm just going to design something. But, you know, there's a very wide spectrum of potential career opportunities for you. You might choose to go into engineering management. You might choose to be part of a design team and build things on a computer. You might choose to be in a workshop and build parts and components physically in your hand. There's just such a wide spectrum that even if you go into engineering with one potential career in mind, you may find yourself changing your career as you leave your degree.
Yes, yes. Absolutely. Like a non-linear career path.
Yeah.
That's not quite, I drew a linear line there when I said non-linear, but you know what I mean.
But, so just so many opportunities available for you that, you know, engineering, you can do really almost anything.
Absolutely. So what do you think are the biggest challenges facing engineering over the coming years?
I think fundamentally it's just trying to encourage that diversity, because, you know, a lot of the time when people end up from diverse background, they see the engineering establishment, if you like, and they'll see that it's just full of, you know, straight white male engineers, and there's just no role model for them to follow or to think, oh, if they can do engineering, surely I can as well. So I think the biggest issue facing companies is trying to increase the diversity. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of companies are trying to increase their diversity in terms of equipment and stuff. But, you know, I think companies really got to think about, well, okay, I'm trying to improve my diversity quota, but like I'm trying to improve how many diverse people I've got working for me. But what am I actually doing to encourage them to apply for me?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what can I actually do beyond just saying we're looking for diverse applicants? Because a lot of companies find themselves just on the website, they just say, we're aiming for a diverse applicant, please apply.
Yeah.
But then they're not doing anything beyond that, saying,
yeah,
you know, why should diverse people even apply to your company?
So do you find employers need to be doing more to showcase, to sell, to be transparent about what they're doing internally then make you want to apply?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, a lot of employers, they'll just sort of do the bare minimum and they'll just say, you know, oh, we want diverse people to apply for us. But then they're not being very transparent about it and not really saying why. They're not really saying, well, okay, we've got this and this in place for you to encourage diverse people to apply. And I think it does still present a bit of a barrier mm-hmm. in terms of applicants. And you will find that, I think that's quite a big hurdle to try and get over.
Okay. And what about like pipeline of the leaders coming after you, the engineers coming after your entry into the profession? So in terms of outreach to schools and colleges, is that something that you've gotten involved with? Is it something that UK SEDS do or Heriot Watt? Like what are your thoughts on the diversity pipe of the pipeline from sort of 2030 onwards and what's happening there?
Yeah, I mean, UK SEDS, and we have an outreach team, for example, at UK SEDS, and they actually go into schools. And they're going to schools from a very wide range, ranging from maybe, you know, schools that maybe wealthier or more well-off areas, ranging all the way to schools maybe in lower socioeconomic backgrounds. And with such a wide range, but I think the content that we found out, kids are interested, kids want to do more. Mm-hmm. I think, so all we really have to do is sort of nurture and encourage that part. And we, obviously at UK SEDS, we do it through the lens of the space sector. So we're encouraging kids, you know, the space sector is out there for a taking. Join the space sector. Look, we have all these different role models and all these different backgrounds. The space sector is really there for the taking.
Mm-hmm.
So we're advocating on the part of employers, but we definitely feel that employers should probably be doing more themselves to try and encourage the people to join the space sector.
Okay. And what do you think about, I'm asking this because it came up in an earlier podcast, so I'm interested to get your views. In terms of, we're very good at doing outreach, and yes, we could be doing more. There is more of a focus than in recent years than in the past, sorry, on outreach. So inspirational outreach, I mean, in terms of like pursuing careers in engineering and STEM. But when it comes to actually finding out in detail the specifics, the different types of engineering, the different pathways to becoming an engineer, that information both for pupils, and I say pupils to differentiate between university students, I say pupils to mean people at school, and also their careers advisors, teachers and parents, so their influencers. Do you think we have a good way for people to find that information out, or do you think it's all a bit patchy and all over the place and very, very confusing?
So for engineering as a discipline as a whole, I think it is a bit patchwork in terms of, you know, for the resources, because, you know, outreach doesn't just stop in the classroom. Yeah. Great, you've come in, you've done the outreach activity, you've left the classroom, but then the kids have no way to sort of follow up, or they have no way of being able to find out anything beyond that. But we actually tackle this problem at UK SEDS, for example, because we also run a careers website called spacecareers.uk.
Okay.
And on there, we've got loads of information relevant to any student, you know, ranging from primary school all the way up to university or graduate level. We've got articles, we've got resources, and that's how we're sort of tackling that outside the classroom outreach.
Okay.
So we're always encouraging kids, you know, after we finish that outreach activity, we always encourage them, well, come find us on spacegrid.uk, come read the article, come read the resources, email us if you've got any questions. And that's how we're sort of mitigating the outreach problem after you've left the classroom environment.
Okay, love it, love it. And I'll take a look at that. So can you tell me about your interest in seeking greater levels of diversity in engineering?
Yeah, I think diverse people, they've got such different skills and life experiences they can bring to companies and employers. You know, I think they can really offer quite a lot more. Mm-hmm. And I think diversity is so much more than just ticking a box and just saying you're diverse. I think it's really sort of encouraging that combination of different cultural, different role experiences, different life experiences, and views and outlooks. And I think, you know, any company that's more diverse is going to naturally produce a better, more cohesive team that can, you know, produce better work, do better stuff.
I really hope that with people like yourself coming into the profession in the years to come, and with the work that you're doing at UKSEDS and the work that we're doing with industry currently, that we really do start to expedite that that cultural change and start to see a real uplift in the diversity composition of the engineering profession.
Yeah, because I mean, I very much recognize, although companies are starting to now move in the right direction and start to improve the diversity, there's still quite a lot of work to be done.
Yes.
And I recognize, you know, if you're looking at like a graph, for example, we're still at the very sort of the bottom of the graph.
Yes.
We're only just starting to move upwards now.
Yes.
And I'm hoping it's one of these exponential self-sustaining things where eventually, once you get over that hurdle, I think eventually there will be some natural organic growth and we can encourage more and more diverse people. After maybe 10, 20 years time, hopefully it will be a lot more. Hopefully you won't have to constantly, because right now, because we have to shift the culture, we're having to constantly revert to, we need more diverse people.
Yes.
We're hoping in 20 or 30 years time, it will just be, we need people.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely.
But right now, we're having to constantly emphasize the fact that we need people beyond just, you know, straight white male.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm very sure that we will continue to work in this space, collaborate together, as you start to move upwards into industry. I've really enjoyed chatting with you today, Craig. I hope you've had fun on the podcast here.
Yeah, fantastic to be here and be able to talk about my experiences. Thank you for the opportunity.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much.
You have been listening to the Equal Engineers podcast, uncovering the diversity story behind leading engineers and those working with the profession, championing change. If you've enjoyed the episode, please subscribe to the podcast on your podcast platform of choice and get notified when a new episode goes live. Did you know that we also offer a full transcript on each of our podcast episodes? Check out our website, equalengineers.com. Explore our wider training and development programs, our recruitment events, recognition awards, and case studies for how we are shaping the future of engineering. For now, thank you for listening, and please come back and join us on a future episode.